this episode.
Construction's been good to me. I met the Queen and Prince Philip in Dubai. We'd spent $3.2 billion, and the way you did it was you stole from other people everything. The other thing about Mrs. Thatcher, whether you like her or not, when she touches you on the arm, it's like having a jolt of electricity. It's really quite something.
Hello, I'm Roger Bradbury, owner of Wren Construction and Chime Software, and welcome back to the Wall Plug and Grommet podcast.
And I'm Ellie Elworthy. Each week we are going to chat through a top topic in construction, hoping to give you some nuggets of wisdom, as well as interviewing an industry expert to see how they got into construction and what advice they can throw away.
So what have you been up to, Bells? What have you been up to?
I'm still on, I think, day four of a hangover.
Of course, it was your big birthday.
It was my big the weekend. 4-0.
Happy belated birthday, Bells.
Thank you. Yeah, copious amounts of red wine and still suffering. But I'm going to... Yeah, I'm on the mend.
Well, you look fine. You look fine. Look ready to go. Look ready to smash our hot topic of the week.
Oh, yeah. So what's our hot topic this week, Rog?
Who wants to be a quantity surveyor?
Who wants to be a quantity surveyor? Who wants to be a quantity surveyor?
Why is this such an important topic? Why do we need to discuss it?
Well, what we were thinking about through this series is let's talk about some of the roles in construction that people might not necessarily be that familiar with, particularly outside of the industry. I mean, did you know what a quantity surveyor was before you left becoming an art teacher?
I mean, no idea.
Exactly. And it does actually sound a lot more complicated and highbrow than it is, of course, which might trap some people into either going for it or not. But, you know, I think part of what we're doing here, we're trying to promote the construction industry and encourage young people to come into it, because I do think it's significantly undervalued at that young age. I do think young people don't seem to be as drawn to construction as maybe they are to other industries. And I think that's, I think they don't have all the facts. And I think if they did have all the facts, I genuinely think people would be more interested in it. Maybe if we start by sort of describing what a QS is.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't even know sort of what it entails, and so whether they'd be interested. So
So
how would you define a QS?
A QS essentially is an individual that is predominantly responsible for the commercial aspects of a construction project. So that's the money, often known as a bean counter or brick counter. A quantity surveyor deals with the money. So they're the money man on a building project. That's predominantly split into two types of QS that would work for two different parts of the industry. You've got the PQS, which is a private QS. That's client side. So if you were deciding to do a building project, it was quite possible that you would engage a QS before anyone else. Often people think the architect would be the first person to go to. That may be the case on resi smaller jobs maybe, but predominantly commercially, QS is the first man, because he puts together the costs estimates for the job, and then you as a customer know whether or not you can, based on your various business drivers, whether you're going to go ahead with that. So you could choose that route, a PQS. They then represent the client. They then would put together the tender documents with the design team, which is the architect, the engineer. They'd go out to tender to appoint a contractor, and then they would manage the commercial process of that contract for the customer. So the customer might be, I don't know, Harrods, let's just say, and Harrods is building a new restaurant on its top floor. It would, you know, the guy at Harrods doesn't know anything about building, so the QS manages that and makes sure that he gets value for money. That's one side.
Yep. And then the other one?
Yeah, so the other type of QS would be a contractor's QS. That could be a main contractor or a subcontractor. You're predominantly then dealing with, you're the person that works for the builder who is responsible for the money in the project. So your job is to procure packages generally, so that's groundworks, demolition, piling, electrical contractor. You procure them, place orders with them, manage their orders. You're also responsible for change in the job. So if a customer changes his mind, you have to price that change, the implications, time and cost. And you're responsible for putting valuations based on a contract. So maybe it's monthly, maybe it's an interim stage payments, whatever it might be in a contract.
Do you think there is a problem at the moment, like recruiting QSs? Do you think
it's... Absolutely. Rocking horse shit, basically.
Right.
Would be the first few words that spring to mind. QSs, not enough people go into it. And so there's a shortage of it. So this is a very good point, particularly, you know, going back to that school leavers thing, then money's good because there's a lack of them. Standard market forces, supply and demand. It's very hard to get good QSs. Good QSs demand, you know, big money. I think, I mean, I don't know the numbers necessarily, but a graduate surveyor's on 30 grand a year. And, you know, if you should be on 80 bags by the time you're 35, definitely. So, you know, there's good money. There's good money in surveying. Surveyors are one of those people that either cost you a fortune or make you a fortune. So the line between having a good one and a bad is massive. And so there's a real opportunity if you are that way inclined, as in it's the job role suits you, because, you know, it might not suit everyone, but it's a, you know, for me, it's a very viable place for young people to want to go and work in the job that young people might want to do.
And didn't you started out as a QS, didn't you?
I did indeed. To be honest with you, ever since I was about 6 years old, I wanted to be a quantity surveyor. Not really. What happened to me? Well, so I got a job in my year out. I got a year at John Laing Internationals. You may or may not have heard of John Laing Internationals. But they were a massive building company, probably the most well-known construction company in the country. For years, they did an awful lot of international infrastructure. And they pulled me in to work in their post room. So I worked in the post room, and I noticed while I was there that the surveyors at Laing's tended to be the ones that got promoted. They tend to be the ones that I think ended up in senior management roles, whether or not they were actually in senior management roles or they just drove the biggest cars in the car park, I don't know. But they looked like the ones that were making the most money. So I thought, you know what? This isn't a bad idea. And my dad filled out my UCAS form for me. Because I think he knew I would never fill the form in. And that hasn't changed at the office now. Now everyone fills in my forms for me. And he got me into the Nottingham Trent School of Excellence to study...
Yeah, what was it?
Quantity surveying and construction cost management. A debacle, really. But there you go.
Did you learn anything there? Or all on the job, do you think?
Well, it's a good point. So... you know, I didn't. I had no idea. As much as I worked at John Laing's in the post room, that was it. I was in the post room, so I did not know what surveying would mean. I didn't know what the day-to-day job of a surveyor would be. So I went to uni, and it was like Greek. It was the building terminology. I didn't obviously go to enough lectures, but I did manage to land myself a job for my placement year with a company called RGCM. A construction management company that built Sainsbury's. I learned the job. On the job, really. And I think that's the thing about construction, is it's quite vocational.
Definitely, yeah.
I feel like I learned quite a lot at university in retrospect. At the time, I don't think it meant a great deal. But what's definitely the case is I think you could... I genuinely feel if I had been... left school at 16, went to work at that firm, I would almost definitely have been able to do what I do now... you know, done okay at the firm I was at, being able to set up a business and be in the position I'm in at without even A-levels, really.
So any funny stories from RGs?
Well, that first year was great. Like I said, I was probably more competent at drinking than I was at being a surveyor or assistant surveyor. But I remember this one time we just started a job. It was a Sainsbury's, and we had the cabins had landed, but the phones hadn't been lined up, so we're all phoning off our mobile. And my boss at the time, Roy Alloway, shout out to Roy. He might be listening. He's probably got nothing better to do. He said to me, I need you to make some phone calls. I need you to order some stuff or get some prices for some gear for the bakery. Because you'd have to, part of my job was to order all the stuff for the bakery. So brilliant and all keen. He wrote a list down for me. I sat down at my phone and started my phone calls. Back then, even making a phone call, you got a bit nervous about. And so I phoned up this number, ring, ring, ring. Someone answered the phone. I was like, hello there, can I speak to Bob Hoskins, please? This, I had no idea, you know. I was like, and he was like, speaking. I was like, hi there, I was wondering if I could speak to someone about ordering some equipment for Sainsbury's. And he was like, Tesco's? I said, no, Sainsbury's. Tesco's? No, Sainsbury's. And this went on and on. I was like, what the fuck's going on here? Eventually, he was like, oh, Sainsbury's. I was like, yeah, Sainsbury's, man. And he said, okay, what are you after? And I said, I'm after one dump handler, 10 Winnet racks and a cream felcher, please. And all I could hear was his giggling at the end of the phone and then giggling down the corridor. And they'd had me on loudspeaker.
Oh, God.
And I must have been thinking, this idiot. And I still didn't know what I'd been saying. You know, this bloody idiot, you're out. So there was loads of stories like that. And I got my first car in that year as well. I had a little Peugeot 205. And anyway, I, for some reason, I ended up putting water in the engine. I'm not a mechanic. And I remember driving into work one day. Thing was backfiring, literally backfiring fire out of the back. I got in there and the lads were like, we'll have a look at it for you, Roger, because everyone's a mechanic on the building site. We'll have a look at it for you, Roger. I'd gone up to probably make some teas for a meeting or print some drawings off. I came down, said, we know what's wrong with it. Take it down to the garage, let them know what's wrong with it. They'll get it sorted for you. So I just managed to get it into a garage down the road from site. And there was an old boy like underneath a car, saw me in his doorway, pulled out, he goes, what's that, mate? I go, something wrong with my car. He goes, oh yeah, but I think I know what's wrong with it. He said, what's that then? I said, I think it's the flux capacitor. And he was like, someone's having you on, mate. I was like, oh God. So I spent a year of basically people taking a piss out of me.
Prime target.
Yeah, yeah. But no, it was great.
And so how much do you think, because obviously you're now own Wren, you set up Wren, and then you've subsequently set up Chime. How much of your QS background do you think has helped?
Oh, undoubtedly setting up Wren. Almost the first skill that I went back to, or the first skill that I had to use when I set Wren up, was surveying. So it was pricing jobs, dealing with money. At the end of the day, if you want to run a business, it has to work financially. And if you haven't got a grounding from a commercial aspect, you've got a string to your bow missing. Now, it's not to say that if you're a builder, you can't pick those skills up. Absolutely not. But I think it was second nature to me, using spreadsheets, putting bills of quantities together, putting applications together, and just the talk that surveyors have, you know. And that's the sort of thing that from the outside looks like it's complicated, looks like it's lingo, but really you just got to learn it. So it was vital. And then obviously Chime was predominantly set up by a lack of software to deal with the commercial runnings of the business. I mean, you remember the days when we used to have...
Yeah, I mean, we did just have a spreadsheet and it just became unmanageable, didn't it?
And that's when you... Cost sheet.
And you... you said we need software to deal with this, and you couldn't find it, and so you thought, I'll build it myself.
So I got a mate of mine, Dave, to do a day a week while he was on the train, and he built that cost sheet, that spreadsheet, into a sort of a platform called Wren's app. Do you remember the first one was called Wren's app? Which was great, and that changed the business, because at the time we were doing about 4 million in sales, and I just found the next stage of growth was going to be really hard. How could we do that if we were all... You used to have to say in the office, who's on cost sheet? And you'd have to close down the spready, someone would open up the spready. And it was, I could see that whilst it did work at the time, I mean, we were doing a reasonable job of it. Definitely the scope for growth was definitely limited by that software. So I thought, let's build something ourselves. And then when I realised, we then went from 4 million to 10 million to 20 million within 3 years in sales, the software became more and more important. And eventually I realised, this is brilliant.
Well, it was helping the growth, presumably, the
Absolutely,
software.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a combination of...
Well, I think I do believe we'd have struggled to grow in a way. We had pains growing, but they weren't necessarily those sorts of pains. The pains we had growing were our overheads were too high, and therefore our margins weren't as good as they should have been in retrospect. But actually, the business processes worked really well. We generally absorbed 300, 400% uplift in sales without as many pains as really we were due. So that was a massive plus.
And so going back to the QS knowledge, you were applying a lot of those for those first parts of Chime, setting up Chime. It was really going back to doing the cost, doing the commercial side of...
Yeah, well, Chime is that element of Chime is the codification of a process that is industry-wide. You know, the QS is due to sell, like we just talked about. You've got your valuations, you've got your procurement, you've got what you call your WIP, your work in progress. And that was actually the main driver behind Chime was... What is my fucking work in progress? Yep. It's impossible to know. You can't look at your accountancy software and understand what work that you've done but haven't invoiced, which is significant often, or on the other side of the ledger, what work has been done for you that you haven't been invoiced for. So your accounts are a fiction, really. You need something for your WIP, and that's what we used to spend hours trying to do, and that was really how Chime came about. So yeah, I mean, if you know,
getting those real time costs, because accounts are always...
But they're only what's arrived. Yeah. And you know what it's like. Someone sends you an invoice for 50 grand from 3 months ago. It's like, oh, thanks for that. But you should know, and if you've got the systems in place and a bit of software in place, then you do know. So that was and that's been, you know, if I wasn't a QS, if I hadn't started as a QS, then I definitely wouldn't have been as competent at codifying that process.
Great. And talking of good QSs, who have we got on today?
Well, we've got Batesy, Master Bates, David Bates, QS extraordinaire. Yeah. he's been, I mean, you know, he sent you his bio, but I've known Batesy for probably 15 years, yeah. He was one, funnily enough, that was always very good with youngsters. He was always good at bringing on, I mean, Batesy's quite, he's what, 60s, is he?
Something yeah, like I think 55 he was born or something.
Yeah,
okay,
so yeah, he is, yeah. He can't have been born in 55.
Oh, God, I better check
oh, well.
That.
But anyway, doesn't
before
matter.
We get him in.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, so he's been around a while, and he's been a man and boy, he's been in building as far as I know. But he's always been really good at bringing on youngsters and sharing his knowledge, and hopefully we can get some of his nuggets of wisdom coming
oh,
on.
Oh, I hope so. Commercial break.
So I had an email from a disgruntled sponsor this week highlighting their dissatisfaction in the quality of the plug that we gave them on our first advert. So when I pay some money, I'll plug them.
Who's the sponsor?
Chime Software. Irritating, really good software. It's back to the pod.
We are so thrilled to have you on as this week's guest. You're an integral part of the Wren team and one of our top-notch quantity surveyors. With nearly 50 years in the business, you've worked for some of the best construction companies in the world and on projects in Bahrain, Malaysia, Egypt, Thailand and Dubai. You are now firmly back to the grey glamour of our offices here in Watford. Thanks so much for coming in today. Welcome, David Bates.
Thank you very much for asking me.
Can you start by telling us how and sort of why you became a quantity surveyor?
You fall into it almost by accident.
Yeah.
When I did my first 2 years training with Rush and Tompkins way back at the start through the ONC period, I got to work in the construction team, the estimating team, the procurement team and the surveying team. And then the mentoring directors that you have from those four teams and my mentoring director for me, we had a meeting at the end of the two-year period.
Yeah.
And the man who made the most noise about getting me to
right.
join his team
yeah.
was a fella called Andy Costello, who at the time was the surveying director at Rush and Tompkins.
Okay.
So I didn't actually pick it as such.
It picked
but
you.
It picked me.
Or someone picked you.
Someone picked me.
That's interesting, because that sounds very organised, as in, from Rush and Tompkins' perspective, they seem to have a plan for how to get you guys
yes.
through.
They were taking on, at that time, they had a couple of people come in at a very senior level from Lang,
right,
who had the best training schemes, probably in the UK, and possibly even to this day.
Yeah, I can account for that. I had a very big job at Lang's. I was a postman there.
Yeah, they just train people, Lang's.
And how did a QS get trained then? So was it
you went on jobs with senior QSs and you learnt your craft.
Yeah.
As opposed to a trade, it's more the black art of quantity surveying.
Yeah.
From people around you.
On the job. Practical day to day. Yeah.
But I think one of the failures of construction today is we allow people to go on courses at universities that are not necessarily suited to becoming a quantity surveyor. They're probably better suited to being a site manager.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they've got it in their head.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting point. And actually, if they could just do a little bit of filtering prior to that, i.e. spending a couple of months at Rush and Tompkins, or obviously they're no longer. Who bought them? They're no longer.
No,
here.
They went broke, unfortunately.
Yeah. Spend a bit of time on a site and say, actually, I want to be a site manager, or I want to be, or actually, I love this idea of being a QS. Happy days. Let's crack on that.
Well, I saw that as a teacher, even. Like, I was with 16-year-olds who thought that they had to go and do A levels, they had to go to uni, when actually, what would have been best is for them at 16, they were bright, they were sparky, but not academic, to just get straight in the workplace. And I think there's less emphasis on that now, but actually, for construction,
it's a no-brainer.
And Rog was saying earlier, he learned all his QS stuff pretty much on the job, and you're saying the same, you know. It's,
yeah, well, I've actually, in the years, I've actually diverted people from QS.
You've turned them.
Into construction people.
Yeah. Because you've seen
that they haven't got the commerciality.
Yeah.
They're not born with it.
So what do you think that is? What is the...
The good trait from a QS is to be able to, I think, to be able to assess the situation, whatever it is, be it a good one or a bad one, and try and make the best of what it is. Get people working with you, not against you.
Yeah.
From early doors, and then pass that on to the construction team with a level of cooperation already in their head.
Yeah.
It's very easy to upset people, still give them business, and then watch it fall apart on site because they're going in with a negative attitude.
And you're really talking about onboarding a supply chain there?
Yeah.
Is that really? So yeah. Basically talking about the procurement of the various trades and packages on the job.
Yeah, yeah. Before the web, you had to self-educate yourself. And the way you did it was you stole from other people everything.
Yeah.
Catalogues, on machinery, on materials, on
subcontracts. That is interesting. How did you figure out what was what when you couldn't just Google it? I mean, a lot harder, right?
Yeah, a lot harder. I said to one of my guys who was training with me, I'd like you to phone a certain person and get an answer to this question. And then he walked past me 20 minutes later and I said, what is the answer? And he said, I don't know, he hasn't replied. And I said, what have you done? He said, I sent an email. And I said, no.
Yeah.
Go back and make the phone call that I asked you to make.
Yeah.
That's great advice, man. Pick up the phone.
Because what he doesn't want to be known as, I've already got my relationship with that supplier. I actually knew what the answer was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I wanted to see what answer he would get and how he would get it.
Yeah, yeah.
No, that's great teaching, I think.
And
see if the supplier gave you both the same answer.
Yeah. But also to make sure that he had a relationship with that supplier, because I'm not going to be here every day.
No. And you want him to slowly take accountability, I take it.
Yeah, take accountability, but also develop. We know now that there's so many people who just send emails who can't pick the phone up and get a favour.
Yeah, we get that.
Well, it's the easy option, isn't it? I think the younger generation definitely have been like fed
social media. I blame Facebook.
Social media, but also in school, you're like fed information way more than having to actually go out and find it out. Like you were saying with Google, it's so easy now just to take the lazy option, whereas you're encouraging people to find out the answer yourself, like go and do it,
yeah,
pick up a phone.
I've also tried to set... I had one young lady working for me and I set her a task. And she said, oh, can I just ask you a couple of questions about this? I said, no. Because I've just given you the task and the information to start
is available.
You haven't even assessed it and you want to ask me questions. Assess it first. You're in a room full of people. Use them.
Yeah.
And then come and tell me what you want to ask.
Just going back to your career, you started off being a QS and getting your qualification. And then I said in the intro how you've been abroad a lot, doing yep. QS abroad. How did that come about? Is that quite an easy thing for a QS to do?
Yes, if you're asked. And I was lucky I was asked. A guy that worked with me at Rush & Tompkins, who's still a friend of mine now, he went to work at Balfour Beatty International and he phoned me up and he said, I could do with someone like you.
I could do with Beatty on this job.
Yeah. And I found myself going to Dubai, which at the time... We were building the port called Jebel Ali, which didn't exist at all. And it was by the time it was finished, about 85, we'd spent 3.2 billion.
Right, back then.
Back then. So in today's money, probably near
120. Oh, really, wow. Really? Okay.
16, 20 billion. Yeah. And it was just a colossal job and a fantastic learning experience.
So you were there for what, seven years? Okay.
Yeah.
And you lived out there. Where's this?
In Jebel Ali in Dubai.
It's in Dubs.
If you were in original Dubai back in the late 70s, you drove out past the World Trade Center, as it was known, that was still being constructed, onto the Abu Dhabi Road. You went about 2 kilometres, and that was the end of Dubai.
Right.
And then you drove another 20 kilometres. There was a couple of bits on the beach side, but nothing on the land side. And you went 28 kilometres, and then you hit Jebel Ali.
So this is a new port that was being built.
The port, 67 berth deep water port.
Wow.
And it was an impressive job, in as much as there are 110,000 odd concrete blocks that are bigger than a 20-foot container.
Right. Well, do they sort of act as a retaining wall?
They acted as the wall based on an old Roman interlocking stone system that they used to carve them.
And how were they put in place? With big dredges or something?
400-ton... No, we dug it in the dry and then flooded it.
And flooded it.
Yeah.
So what were you doing for them? I mean, there must have been a massive team.
Oh, huge team. We had 420 expats.
Right, as pretty much management.
Management, and some of them were the fabrication shop manager, welders and that, our own mechanics to look after a fleet, a plant that would...
So back then, those companies had all their own... I suppose Balfour still has its own plant, does it? I wouldn't...
Yeah, for there you have your own plant and everything. You bring in... I mean, we had light transport, they called it, which was cars. I think we had 80. We had something like 120 pickups.
Right.
And then we went into slightly bigger pickups, about 30 of those. And then we had over 110
machines.
Lorries.
Right, lorries, yeah.
Proper-sized trucks and...
Dumpers, machines.
Dumpers, cranes. Yeah. We placed 2 orders with Foden. We ordered 40 65-ton dump trucks.
Right.
And then we wore them out, so we ordered 60.
So were you in charge of a particular section, presumably? How did it work?
Making the tea.
I started off finishing off all the accounts for the 500 villa village that we built. We had a power station in there as well because we couldn't get power. Then we secretly built a cement plant because we couldn't get enough cement. I was also involved because I had a different view on life in the dredging negotiations.
Okay.
Which was fun. It was a £600 million contract.
Yeah.
To work.
Yeah, so...
To do the dredging. And the Dutch turned up.
Right. They love a bit of dredging, don't they, the Dutch?
With Costains as the partners.
Right. And so they were working for Balfour's?
Yes, but they had their own job as well. The famous dry dock.
Okay.
Where you could put a 250,000-ton tanker.
Right, and then drain it.
Yeah.
And work on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Costain did that, and then they came on site here, and we just had a ball over the negotiations for the dredger.
Yeah.
Because it was $80 million to buy it.
Oh, really?
And that's where I came good on that.
You also worked, obviously, in Egypt, Malaysia. What was it about working abroad that you enjoyed? I mean, obviously,
freedom.
The weather...
No.
Nah.
Not the weather.
Boys don't go for the sun.
All right.
Freedom. Freedom.
Yeah. The Wild West fancies itself as a bit of a cowboy.
You do things. Yeah. We had issues in Thailand, for instance, just jumping onto the sort of the end of it. Same in Cairo, really. We were doing the Cairo wastewater where they suddenly realised that they couldn't pump sewage into the Med anymore. So we had to construct a massive sewage plant.
Right.
For Cairo City, and then turn everything round to face.
So has Cairo City now got a decent sewage system?
Yes.
Does it?
Yeah, funnily enough.
Yeah, I was going to say. But that was a tricky one to get in under
Yes.
Under the pyramids.
And you find little old ladies coming along going, there's this brown muddy stuff coming up out my toilet. And
oh,
you go,
God.
Bentonite leak again.
Oh, dear.
So
sounds dramatic.
It is, yeah. But like, for instance, in Thailand, we were having trouble the first 3 months. We couldn't get enough labour. We couldn't get enough of the right materials, the right concrete equipment to do the job. That it was a petrochem plant. Where the freedom bit comes in, I sat there. We had to take, the Japanese had to replace the project manager. And the client said, we quite like him. We think he'll be all right.
Yeah.
So I became the senior construction manager.
Yeah, because you did move into the...
Oh, okay.
Did a bit of pre-emming.
I've always crossed over.
Mixed it up a bit.
I've always crossed over.
So you must have been working abroad, what, from 1978 all the way to when? 2000? No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Apart from a couple of years, I did for Barrett's, the original Central London Company. I was privileged enough to get caught out and build Margaret Thatcher's house in 1986.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
Where was that?
Dulwich.
Oh, okay, of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've seen her house in Dulwich when I did a Sainsbury's and I went out for a...
What can you tell us about that then?
Mrs. Thatcher is possibly one of the hardest working women I've ever met.
Did you meet her, did you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she did.
Well, you could, because she comes around, she wanted... We had a really strange experience. What happened was...
I don't know you met...
Mrs. Thatcher's... One of the permanent secretaries in number 10 was the wife of one of our contracts managers.
Really?
And they were at Forest Hill, just up the road, on a formal event, and she was in the cavalcade. And Vanessa said to her, they must be the signs to the very nice houses that my David's building in Dulwich.
Okay.
Not me, but him.
Right.
And she went, oh, right, let's have a quick look. And she calls Mayhem and Chaos. But instead of sticking to the route, she told them where she was going.
Right.
And they were going to security. She went, if they know where I'm going there, and I didn't know myself 5 minutes ago, good luck to them.
Exactly.
So that was on the Tuesday, Wednesday.
So you were building new builds?
New builds.
That weren't for her? It was just a speculative build?
It was a speculative build.
Cool.
And at the time, she had nowhere to live. They just sold the house, apparently, in Chelsea. And she only had number 10 as such. which, of course, is a risk if you're a politician.
Of course.
Yep.
Then the MD phoned me on the Friday and said, what are you doing tomorrow morning? I said, I'm playing golf. No, you're not. We need to be at Dulwich at 10 o'clock. Right, okay. He said, but actually, I want you there at 9:30. So I said, yeah, that's all right, I'll get there. So I turned up and he wouldn't tell me what it was about. And she walked in with Dennis.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. And the reason I was there was because at the time I was technical manager who did the design and knew all about the properties and
specification
and everything. Yeah, yeah. And he didn't. And I said, right, okay, well, we'll do that.
Was it a big gaff?
Yeah, 5-bed.
Right.
Nice.
Yeah, I think so. And on the Monday, phone calls were obviously made at the weekend. I'll buy one of your houses, thank you. Because at that level, people don't worry about solicitors and money. That takes care of itself.
Prime Minister wants to buy a house.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
She was Prime Minister at the time. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I never knew that story, basically.
And over the following months, Special Branch turned up and said, you've got some decent security from your past at Russ and Tompkins. And I went, have I? Yes, you know you have. And so... I ended up building it because they didn't like the site manager.
Right.
And then we built it. And then, of course, during the course of the build, she comes and visits.
Yeah.
And wants to meet people. Like, she wants to pick the extra works for her kitchen that we had options on for her.
Buttonless sinks and things like this.
Yeah, and all that stuff. And then, of course, the security...
Handbag room.
The security elements of it, which... We don't talk about.
No, but sign things.
There's a lot of additional security in that house and probably still there.
Yeah, no doubt.
Because it's all embedded. And she was great. And at the end, I got a phone call from Vanessa because I knew her. And she said, Mrs. Thatch has got 3 days and they were spread over about 9 weeks, 3 Sundays, 4 o'clock at the house at Dulwich for you, your wife, and my site number 2, Steve, and his wife, to come for tea.
Oh, really?
Wow.
Yeah, really.
And a bit of snagging.
Yeah. No snagging.
Bring your mastic gun.
Just to talk about appreciation of what we did and how we went the extra mile for
it. That's very nice. No one would do that for a new house now, would they?
No.
I wouldn't have thought.
No. But she was different. She knew we put a lot of effort in. The other thing about Mrs. Thatcher, whether you like her or not, when she touches you on the arm, it's like having a jolt of electricity.
Really?
It's really quite something.
She's got something about her.
Yeah.
An aura.
Yeah.
People like that often do.
Yeah, I feel like people in power do, don't they? Yeah.
Funny enough, Bernie forgot to tell us last time that Bernie met Nelson Mandela. Didn't get his story. Yeah, I know.
No way.
It was one of the stories you told me the other day. He said,
spoke to him.
Shook his hand, yeah.
Wow.
Shook his hand. And he also shook Muhammad Ali's hand.
Mm.
And Denzel Washington. He said he reckons he's met the three most famous black people. It's funny, isn't it?
Construction's been good to me. I met the Queen and Prince Philip in Dubai. I met them again in Sri Lanka when I was there for a short period. They came to Dubai because it was the biggest job ever undertaken by a British company.
Is that right? Yeah.
And then we went. I had to go to Sri Lanka to sort some problems out from Dubai, and after a few months went back to Dubai, because that's the sort of thing we do when you're in Balfour. You get shipped about a little bit.
Zambezi, and they've got an RC problem.
And they came over to Sri Lanka because at the time the Ceylonese had just won the election.
Right.
And the loan for the dam that we were building, which is the one that features in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Oh, right. I know it well, obviously.
The tunnel. And it says right at the end, Balfour Beatty Nuttall Joe.
Does it?
Really? Yeah.
They came to that because at the time it was the biggest soft loan by a British government to another government.
Right. So the money for the dam...
The money for the construction.
But now they had a new government in place. Were people a bit worried about their dough?
They were worried about the Tamils causing civil war.
Oh, I see. About unrest, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it obviously turned out to be...
Yeah, by then it had settled down a bit, but...
Yeah, I don't know too much about the history there.
There's still undercurrents of it going on, but it's fairly well settled now.
So you pretty much learnt most of your QSing trade in those years abroad.
Oh, yeah. When you come back here and you employ tactics that you use with Chinese, Arabs, Indians.
Yeah.
Who are master traders.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So here's one for you, though. I was speaking to someone recently, and they were saying that the whole UK working abroad thing's changed a little bit. Apparently, it's they don't employ Brits so much in a lot of these places. Is that right? Or?
Yeah, no, that's right. If you're recognised as somebody who's like me, I could go, but they wouldn't pay anywhere near the money now.
The money's not as good.
The money's
correct?
Nowhere near as good. But also, we've made a rod for our own back because
we
trained a lot of people.
Oh, okay. So you've been a QS now for near on 50 years. What is the secret? Like, what advice would you now give to youngsters?
What's your secret sauce, basically?
Yeah, what's the secret?
I think the secret is finding the challenge. I mean, if you look at the companies I've worked for, the jobs I've worked on, as I said, Dubai was $3.2 billion at the time. Thailand was $800 million.
Yeah.
And I'm at Ren Construction.
Be careful.
Now, who do a job that's, I don't know, 5-6 million would be considered...
That'd be a big job.
Would be a big job.
Yeah, our biggest job at the moment is exactly 5-6 million.
But having said that and covered all those ranges, it's the challenge.
Okay, some quick fire questions just to finish off. Don't think about the answer too much.
Sure.
What is the best advice you've ever been given?
Steal from everybody. Copy no one.
Are you sure you haven't got that the wrong way around?
Yeah.
No, I'm joking.
Top tip for someone coming into construction now.
Find a decent mentor.
Yeah, good one. Yeah. And if you could bring one thing to a desert island, what would it be?
Glass of water, probably.
Oh, Bates.
Surely it was a bottle of beer.
No.
Back of fags.
Thanks so much for coming on. It's been brilliant hearing all your stories. Oh, well, that was great having David Bates on, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, really interesting. Didn't know about his Margaret Thatcher story.
I know. Check him out. Buildings.
Yeah, he's been all over the world, isn't he? There's not much that Bates hasn't done or been involved with, so that was really good. Hopefully listeners will take something away from that and find a bit of value there somewhere, and if it might inspire some young whippersnapper to join the world of construction as a quantity surveyor, we shall see.
Yeah, I think we want one in Wren.
We certainly do.
And so who's our guest next week?
At the moment, very excited. We've got Nick Morley for a company called Road Grip coming in. He should be a great guest, so looking forward to that. And so what are you up to now? Let's go on.
Have a beer, I think.
I think we'll go have a beer with Batesy. Maybe hear some more stories. There's ones that he couldn't tell on the pod. There's lots of them. And don't forget to like, share and subscribe.
Bye.
Adios.